Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
This is Through the Smoke on Radio at Firehouse.com. Welcome, I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. We're in San Diego, not so sunny. It's been raining like hell out there, but we're having a good time anyway at Firehouse World. Just a shout out to Harvey Eisner. Best wishes on a quick recovery to Harvey Eisner from Firehouse Magazine. Our guests this week are Captain Mike Dugan from FDNY, Battalion Chief Mark Emery from Woodinville, Washington, Deputy Fire Chief Bill Schultes from Philadelphia, and FDNY's Lieutenant Mike Wilbur. Just a little review of their background. Mike Dugan is a 22-year veteran of the job. He is captain of Ladder 123 in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and Mike is a very well-known and very popular fire instructor. Mark Emery is very active with FDSOA, writes for Firehouse as well as Fire Rescue, and is the author of The Ten Commandments of Intelligent and Safe Fire Ground Operations. And again, he's a BC in Woodinville Fire Department or Fire and Life Safety District in King County, Washington. Bill Schultes, an old friend, and it's great to have Bill on the show, is a deputy chief with over 30 years in the Philadelphia Fire Department. He's an instructor, a very popular instructor at the National Fire Academy. Odds are you've taken a class from Chief Schultes if you've been around for a while. And he also teaches at the Philadelphia Fire Academy, and he has his master's degree in public safety from St. Joe's University. And returning again as Captain Dugan is Mike Wilbur, who's been a volunteer firefighter for over 32 years and a career firefighter for New York City for over 26 years, is captain of 27 truck in the Bronx. And Mike is probably best known as the nation's expert in fire apparatus safety, and in particular, the seatbelt issue. Normally in Through the Smoke, I would do some discussion of headlines and news, but quite frankly, there's too much to talk about. There's a whole lot of stuff that's been going on lately, and so we're gonna pick on a couple specific issues as we go on this morning out here in San Diego. So first of all, welcome. Mike Dugan, welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Bill.
Mark, welcome. It's good to have you as a first timer on the show.
Well, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Bill Schultes from Philly, thanks for being here, Bill.
All right, thanks, Bill.
And Mike Wilbur.
Thanks, Chief, and thanks for the field promotion, but I'm only a lieutenant. I'm not really a captain.
Oh, yeah, I knew that was a mistake because there's no way you'd make it the captain. You've upset too many people along the way. That's all right. 10-4. And you are sponsored today by Starbucks, correct? They're hosting
yes.
You being in?
Starbucks.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Okay. Well, I guess the first thing I want to talk about is I had the pleasure of spending time in Philadelphia recently with Chief Schultes, as Mike Wilbur did. And it's always a good time to visit Philly. I think they're one of the most spirited fire departments I've visited. And it's, again, always a pleasure to visit there. But I was shocked when I found out how many civilian fire deaths they've been experiencing so far this year. So how many deaths have you experienced so far just since the first of the year, Bill?
Bill, it's frustrating, but this year for 2007, right now we have 19 fatalities in the city, and as usual, it's in the private dwelling, and most of the dwellings have some of the same characteristics, that there's a lack of any smoke detector in the property, or the smoke detector doesn't have a battery in it. And statistically also, there's really no home fire plan for the residents when we do the interviews afterwards.
Well, you're dealing in some cases. I know when I was in Philly 2 weeks ago, your company's responded to what was obviously an abandoned dwelling, and you found a family inside.
Yeah, from the outward appearance of the multiple fire death, it appeared to be a vacant property because it had plywood over the windows. And when the first companies got there was fire and evidence. And as the search and the attack went on, they started to find civilians inside the property. It was a mother with their children who was in there, and it was a cold night. Again, it shows that every time we go out the door, a primary search and a fire attack is really critical because you never know where some of the civilians may be.
And you're really talking the poorest of the poor in these fatalities for the most part.
Yeah, Philadelphia has had a poverty level in some of the neighborhoods, and that certainly is the area where the bulk of our firefighting duty is in the fatalities.
It's for those of us that track this sort of thing, Commissioner Ayers, is that on my pronouncing?
That's correct.
Commissioner's name, obviously takes this to heart. I've seen, he's had some videos produced. I even saw a music video called Take It Outside. They're trying to reach every level of the community. I mean, it's a rap video that's aimed at the members of that community to focus on smoke outside your house, take care of smoke detectors. What's not working, I guess, is the question.
Certainly, we're spotting the trends, and careless smoking was an issue, and we got the high schools involved, and there was a fire prevention theme made, and the firefighters actually contributed to a rap song. And again, after a fire death, we try to saturate that area two blocks around that death, where the death occurred, with smoke detectors, because we feel the citizens are receptive to the fire prevention message.
Do you work, I would assume, and this may be even a silly statement, but I assume you have a good working relationship with the members of these communities. Particularly, I know in our community, we deal with the pastors of the churches who tend to be the community leaders. And are they offering any assistance and any suggestions? Because Philadelphia stands out right now, but this is not a unique problem just to Philly. It exists in other cities as well, particularly in the inner cities.
Certainly, what we do is each block we try to have some civilian who lives on that block, a stakeholder, come up as a fire safety representative for that block. We've copied that from the police as a block captain, and their responsibility is when new people move onto the block, whether it's an owner or a resident, a renter, we try to have smoke detectors installed there.
So it's almost it's an uphill battle. It's a constant battle due to the economics and the socioeconomic makeup of that area. You mentioned, if you're putting smoke detectors up, you're not going to put them in abandoned buildings. But yet these people, some of them are so poor, they have nowhere else to live, so they end up in an abandoned building. I can't even imagine what the solution is.
The two of the situations were in buildings that you would think would be vacant, but you can never tell. And as first responders, doing a primary search is important, and continuing education of the community is important.
So really just by the continuing education, I think the block captain idea is a great idea.
Yeah, it's a fire safety representative on each block who targets
citywide.
The people. Yeah.
Citywide. That's incredible. I'm not aware of any other communities that are doing it. We have an audience with us, I should have mentioned earlier, out here at Firehouse World in San Diego. Have any of you heard of that in any communities? That's a heck of an idea. And whether it be low income or upper income, that's a great connection, yeah, too. To the fire department.
Yeah, so. Fires don't have any economic boundaries.
Yeah.
So some people are looking at it as not going to happen to them, but it happens in all communities.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. And just by nature, you're joining us in that statement. I'm sure that block fire safety representative idea is going to carry out. And maybe we can even do a follow-up on that and talk in depth about that in the future.
Sure. It's a great program, and hopefully it's going to have a positive impact on the citizens in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Through the Smokes, radio at firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. We're talking with Captain Mike Dugan, Battalion Chief Mark Emery, Deputy Chief Bill Schultes, and Lieutenant Mike Wilbur. We're going to be talking about a couple of other issues as well, including the recent fatality of a fire recruit in Baltimore City. We'll be right back.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke, only on Firehouse.com.
All right, we're back. This is Through the Smoke Radio at Firehouse.com. We just finished chatting with Deputy Chief Bill Schultes from Philadelphia on a very difficult situation that him, the commissioner, and the members of the PFD are going through with these high numbers of civilian deaths. Let's take a look at another hot issue, and this is one that's near and dear to all of us, but certainly our guest, Lieutenant Mike Wilbur, the seatbelt issue. You know, we've been talking about seatbelts, and firefighters are getting ejected. Somebody wrote me an email about 2 weeks ago asking, when are you going to do a commentary on the firefighter that was killed in Detroit, and he was ejected from the apparatus? Well, no one's confirming yet whether or not that individual had seatbelt on and whether or not the officer had a seatbelt on. We're trying to find out what the fact is. But let's, for the discussions, assume they did have seatbelts on. Odds are they wouldn't have been ejected. Is that right, Mike?
Absolutely. Particular in that kind of cab enclosure, it was a custom apparatus with a roll cage type enclosure and built very tough. And we find out that 99% of the time, particularly in the front, if the firefighters and fire officer is belted in, that they're not going to become projectiles and they're not going to go through the windows. In the Detroit case, it appears from some of the text out of Detroit in some of the print media that the seatbelts may have been broken on the rig and that repairs may have actually been asked for as far as getting the seatbelts fixed prior to the accident. So that's been undetermined at this point.
We'll see where that goes. But, you know, when this individual wrote me and said, when are you going to do a commentary, I don't know what the hell else I'm supposed to say. Put your seatbelt on, stop at red lights, stop at stop signs, and watch out for idiots on the road.
I mean, it just becomes that simple, but yet we talk about the culture of the fire service, and the culture of the fire service is it's not going to happen to me, it's going to happen there, it's going to happen to somebody else. And the reality is that there are over 50,000 emergency vehicle accidents last year, so it has to happen to somebody. And it is almost on a daily basis, and we keep getting this, as we go to shows like this, people come up to us and say, you know, geez, three people got ejected from tankers last week, and it almost becomes a weekly occurrence now.
Let me yield to Captain Mike Dugan, who is captain of 123 truck in Brooklyn. And they experienced an incident yesterday, but luckily all your members are okay from what we understand.
All my members are okay. It appears that they were hit in the rear of the rig, and it caused it to slide or hydroplane, and the chauffeur lost all control. And they did a nice job. It's a major accident. But they were transported and checked out, but everybody is okay. So I think they were in their seats. I think they were belted, but I'm not home to find everything out. But they were all okay, which is important. But again, this is on urban streets. It's not on a major highway. I mean, I myself have personally been involved in an accident.
Yeah, last year, right? Weren't you on your way to do a training class?
I was on my way to Worcester, Massachusetts.
Right, what happened there?
And I was cut off in my pickup truck. And I went over 1.5 times on I-84. I ended up on the roof upside down, and I went back to my Scott Pack training because I had to follow the seatbelt up to unhook myself and crawl out of my truck.
Now, rumor is the back of your pickup truck has more tools in it than ladder 123 does, and you're on a Hurst tool. Is that true?
I don't have a Hurst tool. I'm working on that yet, though, if anybody from Hurst is listening. No, only kidding. No, I don't. I do have a lot of stuff in the back of my truck. My guys call it the rescue rig because it's a toolbox. And my stuff was all over the highway, and the local firemen spent a couple of hours cleaning all my stuff up for me. They did a tremendous job.
Where was that? What fire department?
That was, now you put me on the spot. Yeah.
That's all right. You think of it later.
I'll think of it later. We'll bring them up. But I swear by seatbelts, and if my nephew had been wearing one, he would still be with us today. So, but I went over 1.5 times and got out of my pickup truck and walked away. And if it hadn't been for that seatbelt, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today.
Unbelievable. Well, you know, we hear the issues of how difficult it is to put them on, and it isn't easy. It isn't easy. You know, when you put your equipment on, maybe you got 2 or 3 minutes to get to the scene. You got to put your pack on. You got to be ready. And it is a challenge. And that doesn't mean don't wear them. It means you're going to have to delay the ability to provide services. You know, get there and put your pack on after that or something like that. And I know that goes against the grain of so many people listening to the show. But getting ejected sucks. A few second delay in getting your pack on, you know, may suck for the people inside. But at least you're going to get there to find out whether you can make that difference or not. You know, and Mike Wilbur, you did a study to show that lap belts and the chest harnesses are just not working. We're using civilian car seat belts in fire apparatus, and it just isn't made to operate. And now with the bigger engines, right, the cabs are getting smaller. So you're working on a massive project. You got some funding. You got some support. You want to change the way seatbelts are designed, installed, and used on fire apparatus, right?
Yeah, that's correct. In conjunction with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and the International Association of Fire Chiefs Health, Safety, and Survival Section, and much help. This isn't me alone, but certainly help propel this project. We have funding in the amount of over $250,000, and right now we are done with phase one of a 3-phase pilot study in body scanning firefighters. The first part of the study was to develop the methodology and develop the statistical analysis of how many of what kind of person that we need. And as
Your
with
body scanning.
Body scanning.
What does that mean?
There are two body scanners that we have available to us, one at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio and the other one at NIOSH headquarters in Morganstown, West Virginia. And basically the methodology is that we're going to have firefighters go in full bunker gear and be scanned standing up and sitting down. They're going to be in their station duty uniforms standing up and sitting down so that we have a good idea of how much space it physically takes to sit a firefighter in a fire apparatus and how much space it's going to take for him or her to safely buckle up and to change seat belts altogether. The idea of having to reach behind you and then reach back underneath you to gather the male and female seat belt ends, it just doesn't work for us. We have very specific needs, similar to you wouldn't put a car seat belt in an airplane or a jet fighter or a race car. We have different needs than the general population based on what we do and the cabs and everything, and so we're going to address that through this study. We're looking to body scan 180 firefighters. Thanks to Chief Goldfeder and his website, Total Contact, my website, we've been able to get over 500 volunteers. The problem with the volunteers is that, without being too candid, that most of them are white males.
And you're really trying to reflect on the changing fire service, so you need some women.
We need some
African Americans.
Right.
You need people of color. All sorts of people.
Right. The four categories that we really need. We need any kind of female firefighter, whether they be Caucasian or African American or Asian or Hispanic, and then we need male firefighters from the Hispanic community, from the Afro American community, and from the Asian community. We're really lacking in those areas. If you would like to participate in the study as a firefighter, and
we have a link on the site, so just look down at the bottom of this radio show and there's a link where you can go for that information.
Yes, and we need as much help as we can. The second part of the project's gonna kick off in the beginning of April, where we are going to start body scanning firefighters, and then a paper is going to be written and distributed throughout the fire service and to the manufacturers of seats, seat belts, apparatus, SCBA, and anybody that has a vested interest. This is a pilot study. On top of the pilot study, NIOSH, a PhD by the name of Hong Wei, who's a friend of the fire service and a friend of mine, has put in a grant application for over $1 million. And this pilot study is a basis for this larger study where we are going to body scan over 1,300 firefighters. And in this study...
Mike, if I can interrupt, the reason you're doing that, I mean, when you first told me about this, I'm thinking, why don't you just make the seats 2 feet wide and put big seat belts on it? But really, from a legal standpoint, from a standards development standpoint, such as NFPA standards, from an SAE and apparatus design, you really have to do the science before you can just come up with new designs, right?
Right, and one of the things that we found out as we go through this process is that there's no science in any of this for the fire service. One of the questions that I asked at a meeting with manufacturers, why is there 14-inch rung spacing in between the rungs of an American aerial ladder, portable ladders? And nobody really seemed to know. Why? Because there was no science behind it. And, of course, much has changed since the original design of aerial ladders has come about. We're more diverse now. We have females and Asian firefighters that have shorter legs, and we put people in bunker gear that's become more restrictive. And so through science now, we're going to be able to determine what the exact measurement of an aerial ladder should be. Handrails on fire trucks will be put with some kind of purpose. Shoes that will sync up with tread plates so that firefighters won't slip and fall off of apparatus. At the end of this, the major study, which if we get the grant, which looks very positive, that study will start in November, and it will really change the face of firefighting, our equipment, our gear. This is probably going to be the single most important safety aspect or safety change in the fire service in probably over a century, and it'll be based on good science and not somebody's guess.
Well, you know, we've come a long way. I was in the meeting a year and a half ago when you were pretty well ripped apart by some of the apparatus advocates and some of the folks that just don't want to see any change. And a matter of fact, a magazine did an anti-Mike Wilbur editorial,
yes.
Which really, you know, that's good. All publicity is good publicity, and it got a lot of attention on your project. And that same magazine, not realizing what they were doing, recently ran a story about your great seatbelt project, but they left your name off.
Yeah, I got credit for being a troublemaker, but I didn't get too much credit for bringing the seatbelt initiative to fruition. So everything runs full circle, and that's okay. People can beat me up, but this is for the good of the fire service. It's going to make our job much safer for everyone across the country and maybe even around the world, because nothing like this has ever been undertaken for the fire service at all. And I'm really excited about the project. I want to get others excited about it, and it'll change everything from the gear we wear to our gloves.
Well, that's right. The measurements are going to tell us everything about firefighters that we only assumed in the past.
Exactly, exactly. So big things ahead, and we're moving forward. Go to the website, go to the links. We're going to have progress reports on emergencyvehicle.com and firefighterclosecalls.com on Billy's website, and even on the firehouse.com website. We'll have updates as we go through the process.
The seatbelt issue is a continuing one. I was recently visiting a department, and they got a run and asked me to get on the rig, so I got on the rig. I had no problem putting my seatbelt on, but when the rest of the firefighters got on the truck, they're trying to get their equipment on, trying to put their pack on. It was a reported fire. They knew they were going to go to work, and I understand the challenge of it. I really do, and I think we've all been there. I don't think there's any of us listening, participating in the show, that hasn't responded to emergencies without a seatbelt. Well, that's in the past. The times have changed now. And we're reading on a regular basis, firefighters getting injured, getting ejected. I mean, tell about real quick, Mike, the one that we all have different line of duty deaths, and all of us at the table here are involved at one level or another on the line of duty death issue. The firefighter who died under the age of 18, what was she, 17 years old in Alabama?
Yeah, NIOSH is going to come out with a report on this firefighter fatality. You can go to that website and look up that report. She was a 17-year-old junior firefighter. She was in a fire department tanker. There were two seats. Seat belts had been provided in the truck.
Two seats in the whole rig. This was a two-person vehicle.
Two-person vehicle with four people inside. Yes.
And where was she riding?
She was riding on a gear bag in between the seats with the shifter, like, at face level in the truck. She was trapped in the truck. Her brother, who was on board the truck, was burnt very badly. When the truck went down the ravine, the hot oil came out of the apparatus and splashed onto him, and he burnt in hot oil, and he had other fairly serious injuries, and someone else was injured on the truck. The fourth firefighter was not, but unfortunately the 17-year-old junior was killed. And literally almost every rule was broken. In the state of Alabama, there's a Firefighter One course. Well, it was written in the print media that nobody on board the apparatus had Firefighter One. There was an emergency vehicle operators course available in the state of Alabama, and nobody on the vehicle had emergency vehicle driver training. The truck had been a former propane truck, and so it was retrofitted for fire department use. And then finally, the last point, the 17-year-old girl was a junior firefighter, and it is an Alabama state law that no juniors are allowed to ride on apparatus. So just truly a tragedy, just complete breakdown of responsibility and command and somebody being responsible for that little girl.
You know, when we look at the different injuries and the deaths, it's always a minor slip. It's always, well, you know what, let's let her on the truck. She's been hanging around and drilling with us. It's always, go ahead and light another fire in that acquired structure. What's going to go wrong? It's always, come on, hurry up. We got to beat the other engine company in. And then something goes wrong. All the stars and moon align, and boom, and then you have a tragedy. And we're going to talk about that that tragedy in Baltimore City in just a few minutes. But I want to ask Mark a question. Mark, you're the only one on this panel that's from the West Coast. And I guess I'm asking you for your perspectives on, you've got to think that some of the stuff you read about happening on the East Coast probably won't happen on the West Coast. But maybe I'm wrong. I'm putting you on the spot. Answer the question.
Well, I think if you have people riding on apparatus, you have all the components you need for a tragedy. And we put it at what we call an emotional attachment meter in our apparatus that goes right in front of the fire officer, which is a speedometer. And how they determine the emotional attachment of their driver to the incident is they look at the posted speed limit, and then they look at their emotional attachment meter, and how much greater the emotional attachment meter is to the speed limit determines how emotionally attached to the incident before you even get there the driver is.
You know, I couldn't have asked you better for a classic West Coast response. Emotional attachment meter. But that's great. That's a good comparison. It says do 40, he's doing 80. There's a 40-point difference in how much you care about these people. That's great.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I'd never heard of that before either.
Well, we appreciate that, Mark. And then, again, there's another little tidbit, and we try and bring those out in the show, but that's a great thing. I think from now on, every time I look at the speedometer and compare it to the speed limit, that's a good way to see how far off you are from truly being attached to the people you're responding with.
And I believe a speedometer in front of the fire officer should be in NFPA 1901,
that may be part of the change package this time around. I know all New York City rigs have an emotional meter. I didn't know it until just now. We call it a speedometer, but I can now refer to it as an emotional attachment meter. I think the other thing to bring up here, too, and this is on the West Coast.
Or an EAM, if you want to.
Oh, okay, we have to have the acronym. That's for you, Patty. We have an acronym. Our new publisher of Firehouse Magazine is here in the audience with us today, and we were just talking about acronyms. But one other point to bring up is that there is a firefighter that's been charged in the state of California on the West Coast here for failing to have one of his firefighters on board in a seatbelt, and he was unfortunately killed, and that firefighter has been charged in his death. And so in many ways, the West Coast at times is actually ahead of the curve as far as the East Coast. But what happens here is certainly going to reverberate back across the country.
Right. We currently have three firefighters across the country under charges right now. We've got the fire engineer in Riverside County, who's actually, there's three points that they're lining up against him. One is, as you mentioned, he allowed someone on his apparatus without them being seatbelted. They're holding the driver responsible for that.
Right, and that's per state law and also per the NFPA. If you check the NFPA, they will tell you that The standard says that it's the driver's responsibility to make sure everybody on the board the vehicle is seated and belted. It's not the officer, it's not the firefighter, it's the driver. And this is just going to be another court precedent-setting case, similar to Lairdsville, and again, it goes full
circle.
Right, where a fire chief, an assistant chief, was jailed for 77 days because he failed to follow the NFPA live burn standards. So standards are now being used in court cases, and when these precedents are set, everybody in the country, based on that precedent, is at risk.
I got an email from one of the folks involved in the investigation in Baltimore City asking if I had any information related to fire officers or instructors who've been charged in injury or death of fire trainees. So that backs up exactly what you're talking about. And the only one we were aware of was Lairdsville, New York. But I do want to jump back on the issue, Mike. So the first charge was operating a vehicle without having all your people seatbelted. The second was operating too fast for conditions.
Right.
And third was operating on those wet conditions with the Jake brake applied.
Right. And there's a big conflict there, because if you look, I have a copy of the Jake brake operator's manual, and it says something different than sometimes what manufacturers are putting on the truck. In the Jake brake owner's manual, or the operator's manual, it says in the one at least that I have, which is fairly recent, that you can operate those devices in inclement weather, but you must put it on a low setting. If the vehicle maintains traction, you can put it on a higher setting. At any time that the vehicle's traction breaks loose, then you have to back it down, and then if you can't maintain traction with it on at all, you have to shut it off. And yet some fire truck manufacturers, all if not most, have put placards above these devices and said just turn them off in inclement weather. So I think there's a little bit of conflict there, and I'm not sure how good that charge is going to stick in California.
But you know what they do? You know what the attorneys do, or the DAs do? They throw out they throw the charges on the table, and they let the judge sort it out. Right. So it's emotional toil on you. It's a cost. In some cases, your city or even your union may back away from you and say, hey, you didn't follow the policy. We can't defend your actions. It's a different world out there. So the answer is put your freaking seatbelt on, slow down, and don't drive like an idiot. I mean, I don't know how to be more plain.
Right, and maybe Captain Dugan knows different, but in my experience in the New York City Fire Department, I don't know of any operator that's ever had any kind of lawyer or union representation after a vehicle accident.
You're on your own.
You're on your own. You're absolutely on your own.
Chief, Mike, did you want to comment on
that? No, I agree with Mike. I think that if it happens that, you know, you're on your own. And, you know, we all have to think about this, because we all love our life the way it is. And for some mistake, do you want to give it all up? I mean, listen, I just finished renovating my house, and I know my wife loves it. And if I give it away because I make a mistake, she is going to make me pay for the rest of my life.
Bill, you've had some pretty serious crashes in Philadelphia. How about some perspective from you? Are you the senior deputy in Philly?
No, not yet. Jim Smith still got that distinction, at least till July of 07.
Okay, go ahead, Bill.
But, yeah, we've had some intersection accidents, and some of them we weren't struck at a high speed, or we didn't strike somebody else at a high speed, but the vehicle weight is certainly one of the things, the smaller streets. And if you're struck or you strike somebody else by the wheels, you're just going to lose control of the vehicle, much like what Mike was speaking about earlier. So this idea of protecting yourself at all costs is on the emergency scene while you're responding, and when you get there, you got to protect yourself.
You know, and we can develop all the national standards we want, but it all comes down again to the local firehouse. And quite frankly, it's not even the chiefs. It's the lieutenants and the captains riding the front seat. The company supervisor. That's who's going to decide whether or not this stuff happens or not. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back for the final discussion on Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. We're in San Diego at Firehouse World. We're going to come back and discuss the Baltimore City Fire Department preliminary investigation into the line-of-duty death of fire paramedic recruit Rachel M. Wilson. That occurred on February 9th. 2007. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
Okay, we're back. We're in San Diego at Firehouse World. This is Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Our guests this week are Mike Dugan, Mark Emery, Bill Schultes, and Mike Wilbur. Well, we're going to talk for a few minutes now about the preliminary investigation into the line of duty death of recruit Rachel M. Wilson, who died on February 9th. I'm going to read some excerpts from the report. There is a link to this report at the bottom of the screen. It's a PDF file. Overview. After preliminary investigation by members of the Baltimore City Fire Marshal's Office, it is apparent that people involved, including the commander in charge of the training exercise, operated well outside the scope of proper procedure clearly defined in NFPA 1403, the Standard on Live Fire Training Evolutions 2002 edition. Additionally, proper documentation about the structure and its NFPA-approved preparation were not created by the commander in charge, and proper documentation was not delivered to investigators looking into the incident. I'll repeat that. Proper documentation about the building or the structure and its NFPA-approved preparation were not created by the commander in charge, and proper documentation was not delivered to investigators looking into this incident. The house located on 145 South Calverton Road was designed for use in training of dry ventilation and overhaul. That was the only design or the only plan, I guess, that they're talking about here. On Friday, February 9th, 2007, 24 members of FPA Class 19, Baltimore City Fire Department, participated in a training exercise on South Calverton Road in Baltimore City. The exercise was conducted under the direction of Division Chief Kenneth Hyde, Chief of Training, and two members of his staff, along with eight adjunct fire instructors. The building used was a vacant three-story end-of-row house of brick construction that is owned by the Housing Authority. The same building was used several weeks prior in another training exercise that did not include the use of live fire. During that exercise, many of the interior walls and all ceilings were stripped of coverings, leaving exposed joists and framing throughout the dwelling. The purpose of this exercise was to provide a valuable fire suppression training experience using a, quote, live fire scenario, end quote, for members of Fire Academy Class 19. The fire ground tactics employed included engine operations, location, confinement, extinguisher of the fire, and truck operations, ventilation of heat and smoke, placement of ground and aerial ladders, and overhaul. Recruits were grouped into teams of four, with each group supervised by an instructor and assigned to perform various tasks. The training exercise began at approximately 11:35 hours with the lighting of fires on all three levels of the building. At 11:39, a simulated dispatch of units was made, which then initiated the beginning of the suppression activities. Engine 1, including Wilson, advanced an uncharged 1¾-inch hose line through the front door and began advancing up the steps to the second floor. While on the steps of the line, while on the steps, the line was charged with water. The crew of Engine 1 encountered fire at the top of the steps on the second floor. They extinguished that fire in the general area but did not check for fire elsewhere on the second floor. They then continued up the stairs to the third floor, where they began attacking fire in the front of the building. While on the third floor, fire conditions began to deteriorate with a marked increase in heat and smoke that appeared to be coming from the second floor. At this time, three remaining members of Engine 1, paramedic Stephanie Cisneros, FPA Benjamin Lichtenberg, and FPA Angel Perez, were on the steps leading to the third floor. Cisneros began to experience burns to her legs and proceeded to the top of the stairs and informed the assigned instructor that she was burned and needed to get out of the building. The instructor, Ryan Wenger, exited the window that was located at the top of the stairs and helped paramedic Cisneros out and onto the roof of the second floor. At this time, FPA Wilson appeared in the window in obvious distress and attempted to exit the building as well. Because of the unusual height of the window, still 41 inches from the floor, recruit Wilson was unable to escape. She momentarily moved away from the window, at which time it is believed that she warned Lichtenberg and Perez to go down the steps to escape, which they did. When she returned to the window, her face piece was off, and she was beginning to receive burns to her face. She ended up with her upper body from mid-chest to her head outside the window and her lower body still inside. Rescuers had difficulty pulling her out, and their efforts continued for several minutes, during which fire recruit Wilson lost consciousness. Eventually, an instructor on the inside lifted her legs, and she was removed to the roof, where it was determined that she was in full cardiac and respiratory arrest. She was immediately removed from the roof and advanced life support care was given. She was transported by Medic 21 to the shock trauma unit where resuscitation efforts failed. She was pronounced dead at 12:50 hours by Dr. Thomas Scalia. That's some summary from the actual report. Here's some contributing factors in the report. Noncompliance with NFPA standard 1403 includes, among others, multiple fires were set in the building. There was a lack of sufficient safety personnel strategically located throughout the building. There was a lack of radio communication between units, incident command, and the incident safety officer. They failed to conduct walkthrough of the building for all participants prior to the exercise. There was no pre-burn plan or pre-burn briefing. There was misunderstanding of verbal communications between the incident commander and the Engine 1 team leader. Recruit Wilson's face piece was either removed or knocked off during the incident. The unusual height of the windowsill made Recruit Wilson's rescue extremely difficult and time-consuming. The rapid intervention team was not properly equipped or staffed at the beginning of and throughout the duration of the exercise. The RIT team did not have a charge hose line. They did not have RIT equipment and was not staffed by Level 2 certified firefighters as required by the Baltimore City Fire Department manual procedures. Both interior attack teams, Engines 1 and 2, were not fully equipped with portable radios. It's amazing. But you know what? As you hear this and as you read the report for yourself after the show, hopefully you'll download it and go through it, this isn't new. This has happened before. Not in Baltimore City necessarily, because I don't know what's happened in Baltimore City, but we've read about firefighters being killed or close calls related to firefighter training activities. Listed, I'm going to go to one more section report, then we're going to have some discussion. Listed below are up to 36 standards that may have been violated during the planning and operational stages of this burn training exercise. The building was not properly prepared. They did not have permits or permissions. Written permissions shall be secured from the owner of the structure. That didn't happen. Floor openings were not covered. There were holes in the walls and ceilings that had to be patched. Exits from the building were not identified and were not evaluated prior to each burn. Participants of the live burn were not made aware of exits from the building prior to each burn. Buildings that cannot be made safe shall not be utilized for interior live burn evolutions. The lead instructor shall determine the rate and duration of water flow necessary for each individual live evolution, including the water necessary for control and extinguishment of the training fire, the supply necessary for backup lines to protect personnel, and any water needed to protect the exposures. Prior to conducting the actual live burning, a briefing will occur. We can go on. Prior to conducting any live fire training, they're supposed to do a walkthrough. Fuels should have known burning characteristics and should be as controllable as possible. Unidentified materials shall not be used, such as materials that will react violently or create environmental problems. Fuel materials should only be used in the amounts necessary to create the desired fuel size. The instructor in charge shall assess the selected fire room environment. What I'm saying here, gang, is if you're going to do a live acquired structure training burn, you got to do your homework. It goes on and on. And I'll let you read the document for yourself with the download we're providing. But I guess there, but for the grace of God, go I. As I often say that on the show, because on this show we do talk about things that have gone wrong, and we're not afraid to talk about those things when we have the facts in front of us. And here we have in front of us today the report. And I guess what really struck me, I guess two things happened. One, my son's going to be a fire recruit, not in this particular department, but very soon in a fire department. And I'm thinking, holy crow, it could have been my son. Who's going to train? And I've always taken to heart the firefighter death and injury issue, but this one really struck home. And then I thought Mike Wilbur, who obviously is a good friend of mine, Mike's son is in fire recruit school right now. This is somebody's mother. This is somebody's daughter. And whether you're on the apparatus and you're not driving as if they are somebody's daughter and you end up killing somebody on the apparatus, where you're operating in a fire and you're not treating these firefighters you're responsible for with care like you would want your own family, or in this case, a live training burn, something's terribly wrong. Now, another discussion that's been going on the internet and everything else is we need to stop live fire training burns. But the other night, John Salk and myself and Mike Wilbur were sitting around kind of BSing a little bit, and John made a great statement.
Yeah, he said that, you know, and I agree with this wholeheartedly, that this wasn't about live fire training. This was about the lack of leadership and the lack of command. And we can't wholesale stop live fire training because of this. It's not about live fire training. The issues here were about command and control and about following the rules. If the rules had been followed, then we probably wouldn't even be talking about
command, control, accountability, good solid policies and procedures, and officers who have the guts to enforce them. I mean, really, that to me is the heart of whether it's this or anything else we're talking about.
And I can speak, I know for myself and Captain Dugan as well, we have both done, at the state level in New York, I've literally done hundreds of thousands of training fires at Montour Falls for career firefighters and have never gotten anybody seriously hurt. So that's what makes that my statement and my attitude so strong. And Captain Dugan has done a lot of live fire training as well, and he can speak to that.
Mike, you want to comment?
I've done a lot of live fire training, and as everybody knows, I lost one. Like 250-1. Put me in the Hall of Fame, but I lost one, and they all know about the one I lost. But nobody got hurt.
Right, you're talking about a building you lost.
I lost a building. I did not lose any people. I lost a building. We were doing live fire training, and we missed something. I learned a lesson. It was a valuable lesson. I learned a lesson. But we lost one. We lost a building. We did not lose our students, okay? We had a problem, yes. But we had procedures in place, and we did our accountability, made sure all our students were fine, and we lost the building. But you know what? Again, it's about the building, 1403, the walkthrough. You're in the fire service. It's family. Everyone is my family. And like you said, treat them like your family, like your son, like your daughter, whoever. We have a duty, especially to our newer people, to let them grow up to be part of our family. And our duty is to protect them. Okay? And, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there in Baltimore. But on the surface, it just looks like, as Mike Wilbur said, a failure of
the system.
The system.
The officers.
And there are two young children who don't have their mother. And that's what we're losing here. Okay? And again, I think live fire is very, very important. Because if I put you into a propane building and tell you this is how it is in a propane building, and then throw you out and you're with a couple of other people, and you now get into a live fire situation, they're totally different. Hollywood smoke and real smoke are totally different, okay? And I want people to see what real fire can do and understand it and have respect for it. And if you do not fear and have respect for fire, go do something else because you don't belong in a fire service. If you're not scared going into this every time you go, there's something wrong with you.
You know, we look at, and then we're going to ask Bill for some comments, and then we'll go to you, Mark. Someone wrote in and said, well, she pulled off her mask. That's what recruits do. That's their job description. They don't know. That's why we're training them. And that was a missing piece here. I mean, there was significant buzz about, wow, she shouldn't have pulled off her mask. She's a recruit. It's like expecting your two-year-old child to make their own dinner. They're not qualified yet. You can teach them how to break eggs. You can teach them how to mix the dough, but they're not qualified yet. Our job is to take these kids. I mean, these parents loan us their kids. These children loan us their parents, whoever's in your recruit school, and you have a responsibility to train them, and you want to let them see what it's like fighting fire? Hell yeah. They got to. There needs to be some bangs and bumps and sore, very sore muscles at the end of the day, but not dead. Chief Schultes.
Well, first of all, it's a real sad situation. There's no doubt about that. And I spent some time as a battalion chief in our training division, as well as the deputy chief who was in charge of the training division. And it is important that you have realistic type training for all the people that in service or cadet. And but you got to follow the rules. And NFPA 1403 is the best practices. There's a lot of experience with it. And when you inherit an acquired structure, setting fires on different levels is really dangerous. And fire doesn't know whether it's a practice session or a real session. The concrete burn building, certainly offers a lot more safety, and it's not possible for everybody to have it, but acquired structures are a very dangerous situation. To me, it's really poor decision-making it comes down to. So you can look at it as lack of leadership or poor decision-making that resulted in this tragedy.
Now keep in mind, for those of you listening, we are merely reacting to the report that was presented. It's a public document. So we're providing perspective, and the hope is if tomorrow you're doing a live burn training, take this report, take 1403, and you have a guide on how not to get anybody hurt. It's very, very simple. You know, I was the officer in charge of a training burn 12 years ago, and I had some great assistant chiefs working with me, and I had some good senior firefighters operating inside, and we took a break, and we had a 55-gallon drum of material burning on the first floor right near an open stairwell going to the second floor. The staircase area was covered with wallpaper. We didn't prep the building properly, and I was responsible for this. We had students and instructors upstairs doing their walkthrough, getting ready to do our next, and we were smoking it, is all we were doing. We trusted a senior firefighter to keep an eye on the barrel burning. He walked away, the barrel took off, the fire set the wallpaper, and the fire took up off the stairs, and I turn around, and I've got fire officers and firefighters jumping out the second-story window. That scared the hell out of me. I learned a number of lessons, but one lesson I learned is verified trust. And my chief at our department, Ott Huber, has a term he uses with us called verified trust. I trust you, I love you, but I'm going to verify that I can trust you. And that's not micromanaging. The bottom line is he's the boss. And the bigger the department, the tougher it is. We're a 60-person department, a little bit easier to manage that way. But he does follow-up. He or one of us staff chiefs are always on the scene of live trainings. And his attitude is, I am still the bottom line in this department. So I'm going to ask you questions. I'm going to make sure things happen. And, you know, people say, well, you got to trust your people. Yes, but you must verify that they're doing what you expect them to do, that goals and objectives are being accomplished, and that the rules and regulations are followed strictly. And you don't just do it on the day of the event. If the rules and regulations of your fire department is not strictly enforced on a daily basis, they'll be forgotten about when you go to training, other things like that. And it's tough, you know, I want to get along with my guys and gals. Well, then get out of the officer business because you're a law enforcement officer. Mark, how about some comments from you on what we just talked about in the fire situation in Baltimore?
Well, first of all, I don't want anybody ever talking about me or my fire department and the lack of a decision or coordination. To me, a live fire training event is, I remember when I was a recruit firefighter, that was a significant emotional event, my first live fire. And today I consider taking a recruit in a live fire as I'm preparing the officer for the future. And I want that to not be as much an emotional event as that firefighter to experience and model right off the bat that first emotional experience, what an intelligent and safe fire ground operation is supposed to look like and sound like. And that is the purpose of live fire training. It's not to test their grit. It's not to check, see if they can handle the heat. Those are all things they need to experience. But to me, the primary thing that you're doing is you're developing your officers of the future and the attitudes they're going to have when they do become fire officers. That, no, before we go in, okay, let's talk about what's happening here. Did you notice this? Did you notice the fire below if you want to have fire down there? And this is and we're going to have a backup team. The backup team's protecting your egress. It's coordinated with ventilation that's complete, not in progress. That's your opportunity to let everybody experience what an intelligent and safe fire ground operation is supposed to be like. And if it's not intelligent and safe in training, then Lord knows what's actually going out there on out in the field on real fires that aren't being prepared for. That's really
frightening. It's got to be all or nothing. It's got to be all the time. That attitude, that discipline, you can have a good time and still have a disciplined organization. But the enforcement of policies, I mean, my website partner, Gordon Graham, says if you've got policies and procedures, you must enforce them all. If not, get rid of them, because you're going to be even more trouble when something goes wrong and they show you these policies and you never did anything with them. You didn't enforce them. So this is a hell of a wake-up call, I think, for all of us. It's another wake-up call for all of us, I think, because this has happened before. Mike, some comments? Did you want
to? I just think that we've got to get the message. As you said, it's another wake-up call.
Another.
Another.
Right, exactly.
I mean, Lairdsville was a wake-up call. And as Mike said, the guy did 70-something days in jail.
77 days, I think.
77 days in jail.
Never to be a firefighter again.
Never again. Never again. Allowed
by law. I mean, that's what the judge said.
That's part of his sentence. To never, to cut all ties with the fire service.
Because he was a danger to the fire service.
Because he was a danger, and he didn't follow the rules. It's like anything we do in life. There are rules, and they're there to protect us and the people around us. And that's what we have to do.
So often officers find it so difficult to do, and Jay Sargent had a great program, still does, Buddy to Boss. And it's that transition, going from one of the gang to now supervising your old gang. And who knows where this is going to go. I think we suspect we know where this is all going to go. But we'll be watching it to see. Our hearts and prayers go out to the family of recruit Rachel Wilson and all those involved in this situation in Baltimore City. We'll be back for a final wrap-up and a few comments from the audience. This is Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
We're back. This is Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. We're in beautiful San Diego at Firehouse World. And our guest for this episode of Through the Smoke has been Captain Mike Dugan, Battalion Chief Mark Emery, Deputy Chief Bill Schultes, and Lieutenant Mike Wilbur. And we sure appreciate their participation at this time. We've got some audience comments and questions. Come on up. Tell us who you are. Where are you from?
Well, I'm Mark Anello. I'm a former volunteer firefighter from Nassau County, New York, and I was a department trainer. I also retired from the Colorado State Patrol, spent close to 13 years with them. I had the pleasure when I worked in the patrol of spending 2 years as the department's education and safety officer. I worked right under the chief of the department. And that was back in 1989, and back then we first enacted a seatbelt law in Colorado. The thing that happened to us is we made a significant change in the amount of fatalities we had been experiencing in the state. It almost dropped 20% in 1 year because of the seatbelt law. I had the pleasure of being interviewed by a lot of the media around the country, especially USA Today. It was quoted in the USA Today because our change was so tremendous. The thing that we found was two things that related to seatbelts. It's one, of course, that vehicle design these days is second to none. A lot of millions of dollars in money goes into designing a vehicle and a compartment in the vehicle that if you stay in it, you stay safe. We found the seatbelts, what they do is they keep you inside that compartment of that vehicle, same thing in the fire truck, in that integrity of that vehicle. If it rolls, whatever it does, that's where you are, that's where you stay.
You're
if you stay
in
there,
box.
You're safe, yeah. In the box. The second thing that we found was kind of interesting was, and this related to chauffeurs and drivers, was that that seatbelt kept you behind the wheel of the vehicle, the operator, the driver. A lot of the wrecks that we experience, there's not always one impact in a wreck. There's often several impacts in a wreck or a crash. We don't like to call them accidents because a lot of them could be prevented. But this second impact is what often throws the driver away from the control of the vehicle. Now the vehicle is just freewheeling. It's going wherever it wants to go. So the second effect of a seatbelt is to keep the driver in the position where we need to have him, and that's behind the wheel.
good comments from the law enforcement side.
The amazing thing, though, is that these companies spend millions and millions of dollars making these vehicles safe, but we're not using the most simplest of all tools inside of them, and that's the seatbelt.
I appreciate those comments, you know, and I think that that's a great perspective, and it only reinforces the work that Mike Wilbur and the IFC Safety, Health, and Survival Section and the National Fallen Firefighters are doing.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, it just becomes so easy, but it's part of that cultural change, and in your state, you had to legislate that in order to make significant change, and I'm not sure, as far as the culture, what it's going to take for us.
Well, I think what it's going to take is the boss in the front seat. I mean, it takes, you know, you tell your kid, don't stick your finger in the socket. You do, I'm going to smack you. It's going to hurt worse than the shock. And I'm not advocating smacking your driver, so settle down. However, you know what? If you're thinking about taking a promotional exam, you got to study and do all that stuff. But think if it's to determine if it's in you as a person to enforce policies to your brothers and sisters. I mean, that's really the bottom line to me. And we have a great disconnect in our business with officers who have no problem wearing the color hat, have no problem with the brass, but do not want to enforce the policies. So it's a challenge. Don Abbott's with us today. What a great pleasure. If you don't know who Don Abbott is, you woke up a week ago. Don is one of the foremost fire instructors in the country. He's the father of Abbottville. He's in charge of command officer training out in Phoenix. Now, Don, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you join us today.
I think two things. I think we're going to have to start looking at what the insurance industry is starting to do. Starting this July until July of 2008, Fireman Group Insurance is sending out notices to all the people that have insurance with them that if you're in a vehicle and you get an accident and you're not seatbelted, they will not pay the medical care or the medical expenses.
Who's sending this out?
Farmers Group Insurance.
Which is, Farmers?
Farmers, yeah.
Not firemen. Okay,
no,
I was, Farmers. Okay.
Farmers
Insurance.
Same way with
wow.
helmets on motorcyclists. If you get a head injury riding a motorcycle and you don't have a helmet on, they're not going to pay that portion of the health insurance that deals with the head injury. I think we've got to look at the way we're paying out some of these line-of-duty death benefits.
You know, there's been some discussion about, Don, that some of the unnecessary deaths, maybe the family doesn't get the benefit.
Yeah, and I would, you know, go back to the department. Yeah. I hate to say it that way because we're all in the same boat.
Sure.
I think the second area, I bet you the fire, if it's interesting to go, when you go around the country sometime, ask the fire department for their annual OSHA report that they have to submit based on injuries. And I would be willing to bet that in most cases, the fire department that does not seatbelt their people in is not doing 1403.
Right.
It's a uniform culture across the entire fire department that if one thing isn't being done enforced, you can bet there's 15 other things in that system that aren't being done and enforced equally. And I think you're right. It's got to start at the, you can say, it's easy to say, let's start at the top, but the company officers, the person that's there every day supervising, that's where it's got to sort of start, because that's the person we're paying the extra money to basically supervise, the designated adult amongst a group of people that should be enforcing all those rules. And unfortunately, that's not what's happening. And we've lost some of that focus, and I think that's where we need to get back. Now, it'd be interesting also on sort of an area to get your comments just a minute. I think when you look at where some of these firefighter fatalities and the manner in which they've occurred, a lot of it is based upon this vision that we've got to get there quick, that, you know, we just got to get there as quick as we possibly can, when in reality, a lot of these people aren't making it. So getting quick is not necessarily the answer. The answer is getting there safely. But how do you refute that when it's driven by both the media, by the public officials,
so long,
and so forth. Yeah. When you start getting that, and then, you know, you look in today newspaper, 3 months ago, did a thing about what our response time statistics are.
Right.
And they vary throughout the country depending upon how they're measured. But how do we put safety first and that speed second in a system that seems to be driven by the exact opposite? You know, speed first, safety second. Your comments.
I'll touch on a response time issue, and then we can go around, and then we'll wrap it up. But the response time issue starts from the notification of the fire department, or rather, I'm sorry, calling 911 or whatever number you call, the dispatcher processing it, alerting the fire department, then the fire department getting out of their station and arriving safely on the scene. There's a number of factors there. I just read a report of a department out east that's being criticized for a slow response time, which some people died in a house fire. And the response by one of the commissioners to the newspapers, well, it takes our guys a long time when it's snowy and icy out to scrape the ice off their cars to get to the firehouse. You gotta be kidding me. It's time to change. I mean, maybe you staff your station, maybe your volunteers pull duty crews, but so many fire departments have not adjusted to the needs of the community. In some cases, responding from home and getting on the trucks may still work, but there's a lot of communities where your community is doubled, tripled, quadrupled in call response demands for service and types of calls you're going on, and that type of thing is a thing in the past. It's time to change. Another thing that really ought to be provided federally across the country is traffic control equipment, whether it's Opticom or whatever other system you have. Attach that to the system. That'll help your response times. And now that it's not an end-all, because there are departments that have had problems with them, but for the most part, it works, and it helps you get to the scene quicker. But I'd rather deal with slow response time issue by a minute or two than get involved in a crash or deal with, you know, that type of situation as well. So
I'm going to go way out on a limb here. Response times are a poor manner in which to measure the effectiveness of a good fire department. Yes, you can have people in the station. Yes, you can get them to get dressed quickly and get on the rig. But there's two ways you reduce response time. You build more firehouses and staff them properly and put fire trucks in key locations, or you drive at Mach 8. That's the only two ways that I know. And, of course, one costs a lot of money, and the other one seems to be pretty easy to achieve. The other problem is that this whole response issue was first formed before we were even motorized. Nobody envisioned having a 550-horsepower diesel engine that could take a fire truck weighing 72,000 pounds at 80 miles an hour down through streets when this whole idea, and yet you look at the fire service, were you accredited? Or you're part of the accreditation process is that you have to have a response time less than 6 minutes. So what are we saying?
Well, ISO looks at the same thing, too. I mean, the whole thing needs to be looked at. But until it is, the answer is to slow down, stop at red lights, stop at stop signs, and get there safely. I mean, there's no magic pill to this whole thing.
I'd like to make another comment about, Don, about the insurance industry. I actually approached some of those folks in the fire truck insurance industry. I don't think you should get a claim paid if your fire truck is in an accident and it hasn't been inspected, regardless of whether the state requires the inspection at all. And I don't think as a firefighter you deserve any medical benefits, nor do you deserve, or your family, any line of duty death benefits if you've died because you don't have a seatbelt on. We understand that firefighters die heroically, like a Kevin Apuzio in Franklin Township in New Jersey trying to make a rescue. But it's unacceptable when firefighters make personal choices like becoming overweight, not wearing seatbelts, and driving fast and killing themselves.
And who's left holding the bag is your husband, your wife, your kids, whoever's behind. So final comments from Chief Schultes. Bill?
Yeah, Bill, thanks for the opportunity. And I have to agree that this idea with Don brought up about speed kills, but it's not just in a response stage. It's if we're not properly prepared, we're not making good decisions, especially in the initial attack mode, and we can have some people with unaccountable and reckless behavior. And also the speed kills in our community with fire deaths, as we started off this discussion on, that we need to have some kind of a plan and make sure that our citizens are aware that how fast toxic smoke can spread throughout a house.
Thanks for being with us, Bill. We appreciate your perspective on stuff, and hope to have you on again sometime soon. Captain Dugan.
We're talking a lot about change in the fire service, and change is good, okay? It's a good thing. And seatbelts and gear and all these things, they're good changes. And a lot of people talk about change coming from the top, but I also think change comes from the bottom, from our recruits. Okay, I now see you, the recruits. They would never go anywhere without wearing their hood. If we put them on fire trucks and take them around and get them in the habit of putting their seatbelts on, my children, my girls, will not let me start the car until I buckle my seatbelt. That's where my change started, with my kids. It started not only from the top, it also starts from the bottom, okay? It's a two-way street. And I'll tell you right now, my kids won't let my parents didn't always wear seatbelts. My kids, no, Pop, you can't drive us if you don't put your seatbelt on.
So you start with the recruits, and they develop that attitude. That's how you
and
change culture.
And they develop that.
It's hopeless for us to change our culture. It's got to be the young kids.
We got to start at it from both sides, from the top. But we've got to embrace that cultural change from the bottom.
Well, the cultural change starts at the kids. The enforced change then starts at the above level. That's the two ways to affect that change.
Absolutely.
Yeah, good. Well, Mike, always a pleasure to have you with us. And Chief Mark Emery. Mark?
I don't have a lot to add other than, well, first of all, again, thank you for the opportunity to be here in this company. I'm honored to be here. But
You're making my emotional meter go crazy with your warm comments.
The fire service is about protecting the thing of most value. Whether if there's a life safety problem, the fire service is about rescue, primary search. It's about property structure. Protecting the most value starts when everybody climbs onto the fire truck. And it's all about fire officers. And the thing of most value, you can have the biggest fire of your life, but the thing of most value are the people on the fire truck and the people, your citizens driving on the street before you get there. That's where the value is and starts, and that value is delivered to the fire ground. And more often than not, the thing of the most value in my experience on the fire ground is the fire department. And you always protect the thing of most value. And I'll stop there and thank you.
Thanks, Mark. We appreciate you having you join us. You know, and if you don't believe any of the stuff we're saying, if you're blowing it off and yeah, all right, whatever, go talk to any of the departments that have experienced a line of duty death. Go talk to that department in Alabama, ask them if they do it the same way again. Go talk to Baltimore City, see if they conduct a live burn the same way again. It's simple. It's the easiest way. Don't listen to us. Think how these departments would respond if you asked them the question. And I think that's a great way to end the show. So thanks very much to be with us today. Captain Mike Dugan, Chief Mark Emery, Chief Bill Schultes, and very senior Lieutenant Mike Wilbur. Appreciate you being with us, Mike. This is Through the Smoke, radio at firehouse.com. We're in San Diego at Firehouse World. Take care. We'll see you soon.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.